Okay, so how many TAS stations it takes to operate the remote? Okay. I'm going to be running through quite a few things. In terms of kind of in the big picture, the objective that we're really after is to evaluate the genetic potential of an animal. And traditionally, we've done that with phenotypic information and pedigree information. As we've seen that there's move and molecular information is coming along, primarily in terms of marker information, and usually they'll be turning into some sort of molecular breeding value of some sort. And what we want to do is be able to incorporate these two pieces of information into a single number that we can make some sense of. And in order to do that, we need several things to happen. It needs to fit alongside current approaches. We need to be able to bring what we have, add this new information, and move forward. It needs to be practical. We want to have something that's not going to be 20 years down the line when we get around to implementing it. We want to see this fairly near term. And as we've seen in this example here, we have arrays that have 3 markers or 11 markers, just a few markers. We're now talking 50K chips, 500K chips, million chips, sequence data. This needs to be flexible. It can't be something that'll just work if we had a few markers in there. Now, this work is not stuff that I did by myself. This is work that was made possible and fostered by NDCEC. In particular, I worked with a number of people, but I primarily want to acknowledge Rohan Fernando from Iowa State and Rob Templeman, which I've worked with quite a bit in terms of advancing these ideas. In terms of an outline, I want to give a quick overview of the current approach to genetic evaluation. I think it's good to kind of say, here's where we are and kind of get our framework. I want to talk a little bit about DNA marker information. Then I want to take a look in terms of how I'm proposing in terms of incorporating this information into genetic evaluation. The big picture that we're looking at here is treating those molecular breeding values basically as correlated traits in terms of our analysis. We're, in essence, adding additional traits in there. There are some similarities to what we typically see in terms of correlated traits, and there's some important differences that we need to take into account. And take a look at some of the challenges and how we can go about addressing those challenges. Take a look at actually analyzing some real data. Okay. Go through that. We'll talk about a little bit in terms of implications, in terms of accuracies and what happens if you genotype different individuals or phenotype different individuals. Getting into some of the implications. And then taking a look about where we need to go from here. What do we need before we can actually implement this? In terms of the current phenotypic-based analysis, what we have are phenotypic records of the trait of interest. We often have phenotypic records on indicator traits or correlated traits, and we bring pedigree information. The standard method of evaluation is we're going to assume that we've got a number of genetic parameters estimated from some reference population, and then we're going to use, based on those parameter estimates, use Zeflin or unbiased prediction. And we kind of take a look at what we have going in. I suppose there's a laser pointer here someplace. We're going to combine the phenotypic data, the pedigree information. We're running it through a process in terms of Zeflin or unbiased prediction. I've been told that I'm not allowed to use any formulas. Very, very, very tough on me. Okay? And out of that, we're going to get EPD spit out. Okay? This approach works very well. We've made quite a bit of progress using it. But it is limited in some sense in terms of that the phenotypic data is limited. It could be difficult to collect for a variety of reasons. Since I'm going to be taking a look at tenderness, we take a look in terms of carcass traits. Those are a little bit more difficult to collect. And at that point, we're taking a look and saying we want to bring in complementary sources of information. And at this point, we're taking a look at how do we bring in DNA information. And I think the way that we're going to want to bring it in is to go through, have that information trained and reduced down to those MBVs, those molecular breeding values, And so those molecular breeding values that we want to combine with the phenotypic and pedigree information to produce an EPD. I'm also going to kind of refer to them quite often in terms of marker scores. It's going to be assumed that you've taken the marker information, whether it's from a 50K chip or from three markers, and combined it into some sort of score or some sort of number. Okay? Now, in terms of DNA information, we kind of progressed. We've gone from single markers to where we've had several markers, and the example is we're still in the several marker case. We're rapidly moving to having thousands of markers and moving more and more to the point where we might actually have sequence data on the individual. And the statistical techniques that are needed to work with these things are going to change in terms of how you handle a single marker in terms of turning that into a molecular breeding value and how you deal with thousands of markers. So that's that Bayes B, C, D, I think Bayes W is around the corner in a couple of years. It'll be one of those 100 papers that Dorian was talking about. Changes. So in terms of implementation, I'm really taking a look at, we're going to grab that stuff, reduce it down, looking in terms of reference populations into a molecular breeding value and bringing that into it. And so that's going to be summarized into marker scores. Those marker scores are, kind of think about that we have genetic parameters, these are being estimated from reference populations, and that's kind of being brought in. The advantage of that is it provides flexibility in terms of handling evolving molecular technology. If I take a look at that, I mean, we've got thousands of marker sequence data. That's probably going to be the potential for other technologies that we're unaware of at this point. It's a very exciting field. But it also gives us the flexibility to handle evolving statistical methodology. A lot in terms of how we combine that data is going to be going through in terms of these reference populations, using those to train and say, how from this information do we extract a molecular value to bring forward into our estimation of genetic potential. Now, in terms of thinking about these marker scores and molecular breeding values as phenotype, we're really starting off here in terms of the DNA. We can kind of think that we go through, and from the DNA we get a genotype. And at this point, I'm thinking about the genotype that's actually affecting the trait of interest. So subset of genes. And we don't actually observe this. We also, from the DNA, can get a marker genotype. And so the genetic company is going through there, you do the test, they get a marker genotype. From that, and typically you don't see that, what you see is some sort of score that comes back in there. You probably, if it's 50K chip, for the most part, you don't want them sending back, here's your cow, here's your bull, here's 50,000 numbers, go for it, in there. So they're going to summarize that into one or more numbers in terms of a marker score. And this is really a phenotype in terms of going through, this is an observed value that you observe on an animal. And you could have multiple ones of these in terms of when you go through and you have these different tests. You evaluate the same animal, and you get one score based on this panel, you get another score and a third score. So there could be multiple marker scores. We could also take a look in terms of the genotype being converted into a breeding value to which we add the environment and end up with the traditional phenotype in terms of the trait of interest. And really, what the phenotype and the marker score are doing are providing information about that underlying breeding value. The stuff in white, we really don't observe. What we observe is the stuff in terms of the gold and how we combine that. Okay? And so really the take-home message is that these marker scores, these molecular breeding values, can really be viewed as a correlated trait. Similar to when we're interested in calving yeast, we often use birth weight as an indicator trait or a correlated trait. It's something that we can observe and has an underlying genetic component which is correlated with the trait of interest. Now, what we need is we need to have an example now. Okay? And so this is a training, a data set that I was allowed to work with. parts of the validation data set. We had scientific data on shear force in terms of taking a look in terms of tenderness. We had information in terms of getting all the different sorts of information on 410 steers from 14 sires from 36 different contemporary groups, so small data set. We had three sets of marker scores or MBVs in there. We had the GeneStar tenderness, the identity tenderness, and the MMI's true tenderness on there. What I'm going to go forward, because this data set is fairly small, is I'm going to refer to these things like A, B, and C in a very generic thing. With this size data, the standard errors associated with everything is so large that either I can take a look at that and it's consistent with everybody being the same. It's also consistent with them being wildly different. And it'd be a really bad idea to say, okay, they're all the same, and they turn out to be wildly different, or to say they're wildly different and find out there's really no difference between them. And there. I'm going to take a look in terms of a series of models in terms of doing the evaluation. The first is a scientific model. So we're just going to use the shear force to the regular animal model. We'll have a fixed effect for a contemporary group, a direct additive random effect, and a residual, fairly straightforward model. We're going to also have another model, which is going to be the marker model. In this model, all we have is the results of the marker test, no phenotypic data at all. Okay? In which case, it's still a mixed model. We have a fixed effect. Each of the companies have their tests. They're on different baselines and stuff, so it's going to be a fixed effect, kind of a company effect, so just everybody the same baseline, and then a random direct additive effect, one for each of those. And these will be correlated. Assuming these companies are aiming for the same thing, we certainly expect them to have some correlation between them, and they do. In there. Where we're really headed is in terms of this full model, where we have, and there'll be a reduced model coming in a little bit, where we have one of the traits being the trait of interest in terms of shear force. We're bringing in three other traits in terms of each of the marker scores, and there's some difficulty in terms of doing that, and there will be a way to address that difficulty when I get to the reduced models. But this would be the optimal model in terms of doing the estimation. So the full model, we have four traits, and we're going to go through and we're going to take a look at reduced models. They're going to be approximations to the full model. Okay, so this will be kind of our gold standard. And then we're going to take a look and see whether or not we can reduce the computational complexity, make this a lot more feasible to actually go through and do this. We want to be able to use all the available phenotypic and marker scores. And what we're going to do there is we're going to exploit the commonalities and the genetic basis for those marker scores. They're all trying to measure that same breeding value. We're going to expect going in there that there's going to be a lot of association between them. There's going to be some differences, but a lot of similarities. And we want to exploit that using some cool math formulas that I'm not going to share with you today. Okay. So moving right along, these are the DIF accuracies from running the phenotypic analysis, so just in terms of shear force. We have data on the progeny, but we can get predictions in terms of the sire EPDs. The median accuracy for the sire was 0.3, for the progeny is 0.21 with the phenotypic data. There's a range in here. We have an accuracy of 0 on one of the sires. One of the sires was alone in its own contemporary group, which all its progeny were in that one contemporary group, so we weren't able to say a whole lot about that sire in there, and ranged at the 0.39. And as we typically see when we look at the phenotypic accuracies, the accuracies are higher in the sire than they are in the progeny. Now, I talked about the phenotypic model and the marker model. What I'm going to do is kind of jump forward in terms of taking a look at the full model. Okay, the full model had four traits. So on an individual, We could have the shear force. We could have the marker score from company A, the marker score from company B, and the marker score for company C. So since we're taking a look at this conceptually, I want to kind of keep this a little bit at a generic basis. We're going to need genetic variances for shear force and for marker scores, including environmental variances associated with that. We're going to need genetic correlations between each of the marker scores and shear force. What's the association between that marker score that we saw above and the breeding value for shear force? In addition, we need to have genetic correlations between the marker scores themselves. And those are going to be important in terms of evaluating if I have three tests. I'm sure the genetic companies would be happy if you paid for all of them on every animal. If you're paying for them, you'll say, well, if I do this one test, what's going to be the benefit of going through and running another test based on another company? Or if I got three tests, which one's going to give me the most information? And these are going to be coming through in terms of those genetic correlations. These marker scores, the molecular breeding values, are typically a additive function in terms of the alleles we have for each of the markers. And so, theoretically, they're going to be strictly have an additive component. There's not going to be an independent residual component. Now, there's reasons where we might find that exists. In a perfect world, everything works out really nice. We might get a residual component because every so often you send in a sample that you wrote down the wrong ID. Or you wrote down the right ID, but you attached the wrong sample type of thing. Or the genetic company went through and they mixed up the tubes, or the technician was having a bad day, or something like that. So my guess is there's probably some residual variation in there if we're dealing with the real world. Okay? Now I'm going to kind of drop in terms of pointing the ranges and take a look in terms of just the median accuracies. Again, we have the sire and the progeny. Here's in terms of the phenotype. There's that 0.3 and the 0.21 we saw before. If we went through and added genotypic information, that marker scores on the progeny, and it varied. Sometimes we had all three. Sometimes we had two of them. Sometimes we had one in there. And what we see is that the accuracy goes up both for the sire and for the progeny. And what we kind of expect to happen is that the benefit's going to be the greatest for the individual who is genotyped. And so we see a bigger impact in terms of what's going on with the progeny, the individuals who are genotyped, than the indirect benefit that we get on the sire in there. Okay? And so one of the take-home messages is that the benefit's going to be the greatest for the individual who is genotyped. Okay? And you notice that the difference is kind of shrunk down there. Okay? In both cases, we have information just on the progeny. When we took a look in terms of where we got the greatest accuracy with phenotypic information, we saw this big jump in terms of for the sire. You don't see that same thing going on in terms of if you just genotype the progeny, in terms of the benefit and accuracy in terms of evaluating the sire of that individual. Got some graphs to talk about a little bit. Okay, so here's kind of my gold standards in terms of the combined EPD. So that's for the four-trait model. If across here I have my phenotype-based EPD, if there's no difference between them, everybody would fall along this line. And so by adding the marker information, we do get some differences in terms of how these animals are evaluating and some changes in rank. Okay, this is for the sires. So for the progeny, so it kind of shifts things around a bit, got a bit of spread, pretty strong correlation. We got pretty good information in terms of the phenotypes in this case, so you get a pretty good correlation between the two. The next thing is, what would happen if I just looked at the marker information? Now, to do that, I'm going to need to know what the genetic correlation is between the phenotype in those marker scores. I can't get that from a data set where I just estimate the said marker scores. I need to have a reference data set that has both. And so all the genetic parameters are coming from the full model, but I can use that to say, what would happen if I just had data on the markers? Okay? And so as we go along there, we see we drop the phenotypic information. There's a big drop in there. We just had the phenotypic information. We had the greatest accuracy in terms of the sires. When we have just the marker information and we genotype the progeny, we're going to have the greatest accuracy. It's going to be on the progeny in there. And so it's kind of a little bit of a shift in terms of the way we kind of take a look at things. Okay? Now, once an individual has been genotyped, let's say we've gone through and we genotyped the sire, the benefit of going through in terms of evaluating that sire, of going through and genotyping the progeny in terms of the accuracy of the evaluated sire is very minimal. There's some indirect benefit in there, but it's very small. Okay? Now, if I compare in terms of what I get in terms of comparing the marker with the combined EPD, the markers were a lot less accurate in there. I'm getting a correlation about 0.72. Okay? Now, some of this is a part-whole correlation. The combined EPD includes the marker information, so that's causing some of that correlation. I also went through and looked at how the marker only agreed with the phenotype, and they are positively correlated, and correlation is not 0.72. They provide slightly different pieces of information. That's for the sire. There we go. We do the progeny again. We kind of see that bigger spread. The correlation's a little bit higher here. Remember, the accuracies were a little bit higher in the progeny because we genotyped the progeny, so there's a little bit better agreement with those. Oh, there we go. And speaking of which, here's the correlation between, in terms of the sire, of using just the phenotypic information and using the separate marker information. Marker information was fairly low accuracy, and that's kind of reflected in terms of the relatively low correlation in there. But there do see a positive correlation in terms of the sire EPDs and in terms of the progeny EPDs. Now we're combining two low accuracy things, and we got a lot more of a spread. Now, what does that give us? If we have the actual genetic parameters in here, this full model actually produces the best linear unbiased prediction of the EPDs. In terms of if we're doing a linear model analysis, we can't do better than this. This is statistically the optimal approach. Of course, that's given the actual genetic parameters, but that's the same assumption we're doing in terms of when we're doing the phenotypic-based analysis. These are assuming that the genetic parameters we're feeding into the phenotypic-based analysis are the true genetic parameters in terms of being the best linear unbiased predictor. This is the same criteria that we're using in terms of our current phenotype-based evaluation. So we're not saying, well, you need a completely different criteria. The EPDs are the same, they're estimating the same thing. You take a look at an EPD based on the combined information versus an EPD just based on the genotype versus an EPD based on the marker, we're looking at the same number. Okay? They have the same interpretation. And that's good in the fact that we kind of got the one figured out, going back and saying we're going to have present a completely different number to you in there. Another output of that is that that accuracies, okay, just in terms of looking in terms of the accuracies, are directly available. We calculate them exactly the same way we do from the phenotype-based analysis. Interim EPDs, it's the same sort of approach. So all these things that we want to have moving forward in terms of we've gone through, we go and we get marker information, we want to quickly get an interim EPD based on the addition of that marker information that's readily available. There's not we don't have to go to Dorian's middle bar here for 5 years and somebody scratches their head saying, how do we figure this out? Okay? That's all good and great, except there's a difficulty with it. There's a solution to, Dick pointed out that if I'm going to present a difficulty, I have to let you know that there's a solution in there. If we take, we implement this directly, we've done, with the phenotypic-based analysis, we had a single trait analysis. We have three marker scores for tenderness at this present point. If we just went and did that full analysis, we're up to a four-trait analysis. Okay? And that starts becoming a real pain in terms of actually doing the evaluation. And really what's coming into is we're increasing the computational and the memory requirements. It takes longer and longer to run. Now, I suppose if we could get it so that nobody develops a new genetic test ever, then we can probably get over this. Computers will get faster and whatnot. Of all the things I'm really sure about is there will be new and improved marker scores. Even if we didn't have these 50K chips and sequence information, genetic companies aren't standing still. They're gonna say, oh, we reevaluated it and we've got this new and improved test. Okay? Just like cereal. It's new and improved. In there. And now, the three companies released their new and improved. Now we've got three more. So now we're up to a seven trait analysis. And you can see this starts becoming really a big mess. And so what we want to do is to get in a reasonable approximation to that full analysis, keeping it so that it's close, not 100%, but very close, but also keeps everything computationally feasible. And that's where we're going through, and I think kind of one of the exciting things, are taking a look at these reduced models. And what they're going to do is allow for the evolution of these marker scores in terms of going through, and the companies have used the same markers, but they've refined the molecular breeding values. Or they've gone through and they added another marker. Okay? Or they've gone through and they've added 49,997 more markers in terms of the 50K chip, let's say. Okay? But we want to keep these things computationally feasible, memory requirements within reason. Okay? In terms of, and the way cool math and formulas, they're just beautiful. you might not think so, but I think so. Okay. So, the conceptual framework is that given that common genetic basis for those marker scores, everybody's chasing the same endpoint, we expect these to have a lot of commonalities behind them. And as when Mike presented it, he showed these accuracy bars and these little ones. As we go through and that accuracy bar, Mike, gets bigger and bigger, what we expect is that all these marker scores should get closer and closer since they're all getting closer to the same thing in there. Okay? And we really want to, in terms of, exploit that. And the way we're going to do that is we're going to look at those marker scores in terms of breaking them up, those molecular breeding values, into two independent components. Okay? Oh, I'm sorry. I've got an equal sign and a plus sign. Okay? So here we have a marker score. We have an association with the EPD for that individual. So they're going to be correlated with each other. We're going to model that marker score is the random part of that into two components. There's going to be one component, which is going to be the EPD, the actual EPD, but there's going to be a weight component, a regression coefficient in there. And part of the cool formulas is where that B comes from. And breaking it up in terms of an independent marker residual. Doing that doesn't accomplish a whole lot. If I went through and I kept up with my four-trait model and I estimated the EPDs, where I've gone through and rewrote the model this way, I get exactly the same numbers. Those EPD values are exactly the same. where we get the advantage is this marker residual is an independent noise component. And if I'm going to go through and I'm going to do an approximation in terms of my model, a simplification in terms of my model, I don't want to simplify the part that has direct information about the EPD. What I want to do is to simplify this in terms of the model, that residual component. I want to capture the essential features in there without losing too much information in terms of my estimation power for those EPDs. Okay? Now, each marker score will have its own weight component. So MMI will have theirs for their tenderness. Pfizer will have theirs. Identity will have theirs. And when they come out in 6 months with their new and improved ones, there'll be new B values for those. Okay? A little bit simplified is it's really a function of the genetic correlation between the marker score and the scientific trait. The stronger they're correlated, the greater that weight component's going to be. Okay? By having that regression coefficient, we can have different units between that marker score and that phenotypic trait. Okay? So if they go put everything on the same units in terms of molecular breeding values, that's fine, but it also could be that one company does it in expanded units so that they spread out really far apart, another one does it really tight. That regression coefficient, that B coefficient, would adjust and take that into account in there. So even if they don't provide a molecular breeding value scale, it's the same unit as the EPD, this is able to handle that. We don't have to, handle in terms of one's in pounds and one's in kilograms. This model will allow for multiple marker scores on an individual animal. As a matter of fact, when we did this example data set, an animal typically had all three measured. Some had two, some had one, in terms of taking that into account. By breaking that part there, because it's not adding any new terms, it still has that breeding value or that EPD in there. It's not adding anything substantial in terms of my estimating equations. Okay? It's maintaining that sparsity, okay, of the equation. That's a good thing. Okay? And in terms of size of the estimate equation. So if we have millions of equations, we have the same millions remaining. Okay? We have the residual component, and it's really capturing in terms of the proportion of variability that's not being accounted for by that marker score. Okay? So right now, at that little bar, there's also a remaining part that's not being accounted for. So that residual component has a large variance associated with it, so there's still a lot to be captured. Okay? We talked about those 50K chips. I think Doreen was saying, maybe we capture 25% or 50%. Well, that means there's 75% or 50% off in that residual. And those are with those 50K chips, okay, in there. Also, that correlation between that residual component helps us take into account the amount of redundant information with different marker scores, okay? We're going to get the greatest benefit if we have that there's very little residual correlation in there. We'll get smaller benefit if this residual noise component is highly correlated with each other. And that allows us, through some Wade-Kohl math formulas, to quantify that gain and accuracy in terms of using multiple marker scores. So what happens if we do this? What happens if we do that? Okay? Now, if we take a look at the case where the marker scores are only available on unrelated animals, okay, and we take a look in terms of what the computational requirements in terms of reparameterizing this way, the changes in terms of the estimation equations are trivial. We might be adding a few more things to estimate, like three or four when we have millions in there. Where we get kind of an issue is when we genotype related individuals. And in this example data set, we clearly, since we're genotyping half sibs, they are half sibs are usually related to each other. Okay, I'm going to make that assumption. Okay, and so if we were to kind of do this and go back and fit the model without doing any simplification, we're really back up to the full model in terms of now we have a four-trait model again, and there's no benefit from that. What we're going to do is, because of the independence between the residual and the EPD, the thing in there, what we're going to do is trying to exploit those commonalities, do the simplification there, reduce the number of traits in there. So as opposed to doing a four-trait, maybe we can reduce it to a three-trait model. Or maybe as opposed to doing four traits, we can reduce it all the way back to two. Or we could reduce it down to one. Okay? And I just said that. Okay? And so I'm going to take a look next at looking at two reduced models. So what worked? Okay, we have three marker scores that are actually being used. I got an example data set so I can kind of go through and estimate the genetic parameters. Not very good estimates, but they give me an idea in terms of what kind of impact I'd want to see. I'm going to see what happens if I go from a 4 to a 3, or go all the way down to a true trait model in there, which will have substantial reductions in terms of the computational requirements. Okay? Kind of looked at these before. Here's the combined EPD. Here's basically we're doing first simplification. I drop one of the traits out in there. And I take a look at what I get in terms of my sire EPDs, estimated with combined model and my approximate reduced model. I get a somewhat decent correlation of 0.99. Okay? And if I take a look, that's pretty good. There may be some little changes in ranking in there someplace, but not very much in there. If I take a look at the progeny, which I have a lot more, okay, well, I've got a lousy correlation of 0.99 again. And I take a look, and it looks pretty clear that we have a group of highly related individuals that we're genotyping in here, and we can at least simplify it that one step without losing a whole lot of information. If I go through and I basically go from 4 and I dropped off 2 of the traits, so I'm basically having a phenotype and you kind of think a marker score combined would be one way to kind of take a look at it. And I look at the correlation between the sire EPDs between doing the full model and the 2 traits, okay? Not quite as good. I'm down to a correlation of 0.98, but it's still pretty good. If it means a difference in terms of being able to incorporate this marker information or not, okay. And for the progeny, okay, it's a little smaller 0.99 than the 0.99 before. Okay. There's a little bit more spread there, but in terms of going through, at least kind of based on this limited thing, but there's certainly a lot of potential in terms of going through, taking this approach, and looking at these simplifications in here. And so I think kind of where we're going to be headed is somewhere along those lines. I think it keeps it to the point where we're going through and able to incorporate that DNA information that we aren't getting the optimal, but we're getting pretty darn close. And I'm going to kind of put this in terms of some graphics. Here's where we're kind of now in terms of the phenotype model and in terms of what those scatter plots look like in terms of kind of this combined optimal model in terms of definitely unbiased prediction and what we get with the reduced model. We're capturing a large portion of the information that's out there in terms of even with that reduced model and similar in terms of the progeny information. So I think it provides a way that we might not be able to get to the theoretically optimal model, but we can get pretty darn close in there. Now, take a little bit look in terms of the accuracies, and I could probably spend an hour or two, there's all sorts of interesting things you can take, well, what if we did this and what if we did that? And I don't think you want to listen to me as I go through all of that. Maybe you do, so I don't know if I want to talk that long. So I kind of took a look at the parameter estimates that we got from there and kind of said, well, the heritability was about 0.4, and when I got the genetic correlation, it bounced around, but kind of somewhere around 0.45. It kind of seemed to be kind of a typical one. And first I said, well, let's say that we're looking at just one marker score, so I'm not taking a look at, well, what happens if I add 2 and 3, and what if I compare company A versus company B in there, where I'm taking a look at a data set where we have 10 sires and we have 10 progenies per sire, and taking a look at what happens to the accuracy. So in this case, we're getting a fair amount of phenotypic information on each sire in here. And so at this point, the benefit of getting that marker information is going to be relatively minimal in there. So if I take a look in terms of the progeny where I don't genotype, I get an accuracy of 0.27 and 0.24 for the progeny. If I just genotype the progeny, again, I see that larger benefit in terms of accuracy in terms of the progeny, and really not much benefit in terms of evaluating that sire. If, on the other hand, I say, well, I don't want to genotype those 10 progeny. I'm interested in terms of the sire. So I guess it's 100 progeny. If I go through and just genotype the 10 sires, if I take a look at what happens, I get the lot bigger bang in terms of the information, in terms of improvement of accuracy for the sire. But since I'm not genotyping the progeny, there's very marginal information. And if I go through and saying, I've daddy big bucks, and I'm going to genotype everybody. If I genotype both, you get a little bit of gain in both. I go from 0.29 to 0.29 by the addition of sire information. I go from 0.31 to 0.33 in terms of sire by adding the progeny information. Okay, there's some benefits, kind of indirect. What you gain by genotyping the progeny is you get a little bit of better in terms of that non-marker component of the breeding value for that progeny. You've reduced some of that information. So there's a little bit of benefit in there. If I'm not going to do any phenotype information, take a look in terms of just genotyping. If I just genotype the progeny, I get a little bit in terms of the sire, better than zero. I see the main benefit in terms of the progeny. If I genotype the sire, okay, I'm getting a benefit in terms of the sire, not much benefit in terms of the progeny in there. This is a little bit lower here because I just have 10 sires, and I estimate that base in there, and I just have 10 numbers as opposed to 100 numbers to estimate it. If I go from the sire and I add progeny information, there's really no benefit in there in terms of evaluating the sire. In terms of the progeny, if I add sire information, I don't really see any benefit in terms of evaluating the progeny. So kind of a more fair basis, let's say what would be the value in terms of getting the phenotype on one progeny versus marker information on one individual. Okay? Well, if I just genotype one of the progeny, I'm not doing a very bang-up job in terms of accuracy of the sire. Does help me in terms of the progeny. If I go through and, let's see, whoops. Okay, so here's just in terms of the phenotype. If I go through and I genotype the progeny in terms of getting the phenotype, okay. I get a bit more benefit there. It's not really adding a whole lot of information in there. So if I'm going through there and I'm just going to genotype one individual and I'm interested in the sire, it's probably not going to be one of the progeny. If I go in as opposed to genotype one of the progeny of the sire, I say I'm going to genotype the sire himself. Okay. I see a much larger benefit. Okay. Really, genotyping the sire doesn't help me a whole lot in terms of the progeny. And going through and doing both, I don't see a real benefit in terms of the sire by adding progeny information once I've genotyped the sire. Similarly, if I've genotyped the progeny, adding the genotype of the sire information doesn't help me. And if we do it without phenotypic information, similar sort of story. You get the biggest bang for genotyping the individual of interest. Once you genotype the individual of interest, there's really fairly marginal benefit for genotyping relatives in terms of the accuracy of that individual. Sure. This last slide or the last one? Yes. Okay, yeah.
Is that all, did you combine the effects of company A, B, and C?
Okay, so in terms of this is just saying I got a single marker score based on a parameter estimate from a data set, which is probably not the right data set parameters from, I mean, those standard errors. And so whether it's actually turns out to be 0.1, really trying to go back, was that correlation actually 0.45 in there? But this is for one marker score, okay? So a little bit of a caution in terms of it. I think in terms of the general story, in terms of what's happening, I think this bears out fairly well. Let's see. Okay, any other questions on this before I click the wrong button? There we go. Okay, let's see, I think I did that. Okay, so in terms of the take-home message, once that individual's been genotyped, there's minimal benefit in terms of genotyping relatives. There is some indirect benefit that we saw. And as expected, that you get the greatest benefit in terms of genotyping animals which have limited phenotypic information. If we got lots of phenotypic information, going back and genotyping that individual doesn't help you much in terms of accuracy. It's when you have limited phenotypic information that you get the greatest benefit. Say a little bit about interim EPDs. In terms of a simplified sense, in terms of what does an interim EPD does, is it takes the EPD from the current evaluation, basically the average of the parental EPDs, along with some new information, the phenotype of the individual, let's say. Okay, that needs to be adjusted in terms of taking terms of the contemporary. There's some adjustments in terms of taking care of the breeding values of the parents in there. So some adjustments in there. Okay, this new information is given a weight in terms of adjusted, added on there, and that's where the interim EPD comes from. We can do the same, conceptually the same thing with the marker scores. Basically, we're adding a new piece of information. So from a mathematical, statistical standpoint, it's a very straightforward procedure. We'll have to go through. We'll need to adjust the marker scores, basically the same way we do adjust a new phenotypic record. There'll need to be an appropriate weight in terms of bringing that in there. That'll depend on those genetic parameters, which we're going to need to get from some reference populations. So it's going to depend on those genetic variants, covariances. And so it's relatively straightforward to go through and get those interim EPDs. In terms of where we're at this point, I think in terms of methodology, just give us a way in terms of going through and how can we go about combining these information together, this information together with some optimality criteria, okay, in there, that we have methodology that's based on linear mixed models is very robust, very solid, very familiar. These are things we're working with. We're comfortable in terms of figuring out how we actually compute these things efficiently. There's been a lot of lessons learned. We're able to get out EPDs, which are the same interpretation as the EPDs we had before. It's not a MEPD, it's an EPD. We get accuracies the same way as before. We get interim EPDs, basically the same way as before. It's a relatively straightforward extension. Now, I'm saying that in the fact that I'm not the one who's best to program it in there. But in terms of these evaluations, they had to be carried out with a statistical package. Basically, I took a standard linear model program, I can fit ASREML, said, fit this model for me, and it went through and fit it. I didn't have to write some specialized software to fit these models. These are standard linear mixed models. Okay? So it's an extension. And one of the advantages are we've learned a lot of lessons over the years on how to do these things very effectively, do it quickly, how to interpret them, how to extend that knowledge out to the user base. And we can make use of those lessons that we learned. We don't have to go back to square one thing. This is something completely different. We have to relearn everything, figure out how to handle all these issues. This stuff is in place already. Is it all done? Well, no. We need estimation of those genetic parameters. You saw I hemmed and hawed when I said the 0.1. Okay? The general story is correct, but I can change that 0.1 quite a bit in terms of the estimates of the genetic parameters. Like I said, I took a look at those different micro scores for the different companies, and it's consistent with them all being equally valuable. It's also consistent with them being wildly different. I really don't have enough information to tell you which one's better or which one's worse at this point, or if they're really all the same and by whichever one's the cheapest. Okay? We need to take a look in terms of reporting criteria, okay? What's the impact of selective reporting? Is there ways that we can handle that in terms of adding things to our model? Mark pointed out, well, maybe we can just add a contemporary breeder effect, and that'll take care of that selective reporting, similar to how we, the impact in terms of adding a contemporary group effect, okay? And we have to determine the criteria of when a marker score is ready to be included. We have to have genetic parameter estimates that are good enough that we're actually adding information, getting improvement. We don't have so much noise in there that we're just adding noise to our evaluation. Okay? And I think this really is a step beyond where we currently go in terms of validation. Now, it could be something that validation turns out to be the same problem. This is kind of where we might want to be going in terms of a marker is validated when it's evaluated to be ready to be included as part of the EPD. Maybe, maybe not. We have to evaluate the trade-off between computational requirements and model complexity. We go through kind of those reduced models. Okay, we've gone through, they're not quite as good as the full model, but they look to be pretty good. How far can we go? I went 3 to 2. Could I have gone down to 1? That could depend in terms of how that marker information, if we're getting marker information that's on unrelated individuals, we can go down to a one-trait model. I don't think that's where we're going to be. We're going to be getting marker information on related individuals in there. Okay? Another big thing is in terms of software development. Okay? These are, the models are very similar to what we're doing now. There's some modifications. Not too much. Basically, if we were doing a single trait model, now we're kind of programs where we have a 2 or 3 trait model in there. So there's work to be done in terms of going through and implementing it in there, but basically it's the same sorts of procedures that we're using before. Okay. Well, that's what I have to say for now. I kept it down to 1 plus sign, 1 equal sign. You should be impressed. Are there any questions out there that I might be able to address at this point? Or have I, sometimes I get this glazed look when I'm teaching statistics and going in there. Not looking too glazed, so that's okay. Yes, sorry.
Steve, you said you didn't change the accuracy very much, except on
That's where you saw the biggest change in accuracy.
What about the EPDs? You changed the EPDs
of relative very much,
even though their accuracy
doesn't change. Okay. Okay. And so if we kind of took a look at the difference between the Sire the phenotype and the combined, which has kind of disappeared. Things didn't fall on that same line. There was kind of a spread. We didn't genotype the sire, okay? But the sire EPDs did change in there. So it's kind of in that graph. I think the correlation was like, it was either 0.7 or 0.8. So there's some change. Okay.
If you only did a few animals in the National Cattle Evaluation Registry with genotypes, their accuracy will go up.
Right.
But the accuracies in the other animals probably won't change very much. Will the rank correlation of the other animals change very much?
Okay. So if I go through and I just genotype a few individuals, there'll obviously be a change in the accuracy for those individuals, and depending on the amount of phenotypic information that went into it, there you will see fairly sizable changes in terms of their ranking. Okay, what happens in terms of the rankings of the other individuals in terms of how much they change? I'd have to speculate at this point. My guess is that if you're going through and you're comparing individuals who have progeny or whatever in the same contemporary group, you've improved the accuracy in terms of the sire producing in one, in terms of comparing it to another one. I think that you could see some differences. I haven't really looked at it, but I think you'd see some impact. That's a really good question.
Well, when you have a few million animals in a national cattle evaluation and you genotype a few thousand, the question is going through all the complexity and rerunning the evaluation with a few million animals going to be worthwhile in terms of changing the ranking of the ones that weren't genotyped? Or would it be more sensible to just merge the molecular and EPD information only on the animals that have genotypes?
Well, as I see it, that if we're going to be going through and we're going to be running an evaluation, that, and I'm not seeing a huge increase in terms of the computational complexity, I would think that you'd want to include both sources of information, because you're going to want to combine that molecular information anyway for the animals that were genotyped. And that'll obviously have some impact in terms of how they compare to other individuals in there. So I think part of the process, you're going to want to use all the information together. Whether every time I get a new piece of information, if I want to run the whole evaluation, no. But the evaluations get run from time to time anyway, and I would see that being part of the normal process in there. And I would think that if you've gone through and you've paid to have this animal genotyped, okay, one of the things you're paying for is a more accurate evaluation of that individual. You want to get the most accurate evaluation, even if your neighbor's evaluation doesn't benefit very much in terms of changes in ranks and stuff. John? I think John wants to say something.